Welcome everyone to our weekly Strong Gravity seminar. A note about the format. Justin will give his talk, and if you have some pressing question, then you can chime in during it. But then at the end, I'll ask for questions and people can raise their hands so we can have more discussion. I have been told that we have a hard deadline of 2:15, which the meeting has to end by then, so they can start the next one. Today we're very pleased to have Justin Ripley from Princeton, and I guess he'll be moving to Cambridge in the fall. And so Justin's been doing some very interesting work on looking at alternative theories of gravity to general relativity and trying to understand their dynamics and test them. So today he'll be telling us about testing general relativity and the nonlinear dynamics of modified gravity theories. So thanks very much, Justin.
Thanks for letting me speak. And I'll try to also pause between different sections to see if anyone has any questions, because sometimes audio can be a little tricky with this. As Will said, I'll be talking about testing general relativity and the nonlinear dynamics of modified gravity. In particular, I'll be talking about a particular modified gravity theory today called Einstein-Dillerton-Gauss-Binet, and mostly discussing the results from these three papers down here at the bottom. And a lot of this work I've been doing with my thesis advisor, Franz Pretorius. I'll briefly motivate why we're looking at modified gravity. One big motivation for us was we wanted to do model selection tests with LIGO-Virgo gravitational wave data during the merger stage of two objects when gravity is at its strongest and most dynamical. And the intuition is that having non-perturbative corrections to GR and understanding those corrections could give strong constraints on potential deviations from the theory. A more physics end is also to people look at modified gravity theories to study dark energy, dark matter, and in particular, in the models in the early universe, for example, inflation or bouncing models, people often modify gravity there. And just to talk a little bit more about that, the null convergence condition, people often modify gravity to violate this condition, which is, I'm writing it here. So I'm always working in four space-time dimensions, signature minus, plus, plus, plus. And that the null convergence condition is that the Ricci tensor contracted with two null vectors, for any two null vectors you choose, the same ones, always has to be bounded from always positive definite. This theorem has played a role for a long time in the incompleteness theorems, in particular, the incompleteness of the FRW cosmologies and completeness inside black holes. And it's well known that standard classical matter fields can't stably violate this energy condition. And people have looked to modifying general relativity to overcome, say, these incompleteness in the solutions of general relativity. And just to show you two examples, I won't be studying these models, but just examples people have looked at in the literature. There's, for example, Galileo and Genesis, where people look at the density. So we have Ricci scalar plus scalar field. And then for me, modified gravity means you're adding new terms that have higher derivatives. So these terms in red, they add these to violate the null convergence condition. And then people also look at, more recently, Aisch and Steiner have looked at these bouncing cosmologies where they also add higher derivative terms to the Einstein-Hilbert action to violate the null convergence condition and overcome these incompleteness theorems. So beyond just testing general relativity, people are modifying gravity to solve real problems that they see in, say, cosmology. So when it comes to studying modified gravity theories, there's sort of two main camps. There are people who study exact solutions to a particular modified gravity theory, like dynamical Chern-Simons, or for us, we'll be studying EDGB, Einstein-Dillerton-Gauss-Binet, massive gravity, and so on. And then people also study effective corrections of general relativity, where they say, well, I don't know the exact modification general relativity will have, but I can impose some sort of symmetries and write down all the terms that are consistent with those symmetries order by order and the coupling or some energy scale. This is a bit more theory agnostic, but here we can study the features of the modification more in depth. And we'll be taking this first approach here today. So going to the nonlinear dynamics of EDGB, our goal is to study the full equations of this theory, which I'll introduce in the next slide. The challenge to this sort of approach is that we didn't have to understand the theory has a well-posed initial value problem, obeys cosmic censorship, just that the idea that it has to make sense as a classical field theory, the partial differential equations have to be solvable and make sense. The reward, though, to this approach is that we can understand how modifications of GR affect the nonlinear dynamics, say when two black holes merge, but also the physics of the early universe. So there's some serious restrictions about the kind of partial differential equations the theory has to satisfy to make sense as evolution equations, but the reward could also be great there as well. So in particular, here's the theory I'll be talking about today. Here's the Ricci scalar, here's the action. We have a massless scalar, but then we also add this coupling. Lambda is a constant, and we're coupling phi to the Gauss-Bonnet scalar, which I'm just writing here. This theory can be motivated using effective field theory arguments. So long ago, it was shown that this coupling, so I'm now writing this the general function w, but we're only looking at w equal phi. This contains the leading order scalar tensor interaction that cannot be removed by a conformal transformation in the action. And in particular, if we look at our shift symmetric case, so this theory is invariant under shifts in phi. Phi goes to phi plus a constant because this Gauss-Bonnet scalar is a total derivative. It doesn't affect the dynamics, so we have to couple it. So it's invariant under shifts, phi to phi plus constant. And this shift symmetric EDGB gravity is the unique theory of its kind that has second order equations of motion, but does not admit stationary Schwarzschild black hole solutions. So the idea is that scalar field will scalarize around black holes. And more in depth why we're considering this theory is that there are very few modified gravity theories that satisfy these three conditions we want to have. So that are consistent with general relativity in regimes where it is well tested. But they also predict observable deviations from general relativity in the strong field dynamical regime, for example, where two black holes merge. But they also have to make sense as classical field theories. Possess a classically well-posed initial value problem. And EDGB gravity, well, it's not too highly constrained by, for example, binary pulsar tests, so other tests of general relativity, because the scalar field isn't activated as strongly around neutron stars, but it actually is sort of activated more strongly around event horizons. We'll get to that more later, but we can just take it for now that it's not highly constrained by other tests of general relativity. We suspect it will produce observable large deviations around black holes because the EDGB term scalarizes more strongly around objects with event horizons. And the last thing though we need to check, and that was sort of the focus of the studies and we'll be talking more about, is does this theory, taken as a classical field theory, have a well-posed initial value problem? And the equations of motion are second order in time, which gave a lot of hope that these theories would, but it doesn't guarantee that they will. So we'll be studying that more in detail. So here are the equations of motion for the Einstein-Dillerton Gauss-Bonnet, the shift symmetric version we're studying. Here is the vary with respect to the metric, and we get the Einstein tensor. We get the mixing between the Gauss-Bonnet term and the scalar field. So here's the Riemann tensor, here's the anti-symmetric tensor, here's our coupling lambda, here's phi. The standard massless scalar part gives us this stress energy for phi. And if we vary phi, we get this equation of motion for phi, box phi plus lambda g. So all of this involves two derivatives, but there's some mixing here, which might cause us problems. So this theory is Ostrogradsky stable. Okay, now I'm gonna talk about our numerical studies of this theory. So I'll be presenting results from EDGB gravity in spherical symmetry, which is more restricted than the general. We don't want to go for the full non-symmetric case first. We don't quite know if this theory makes sense as PDEs yet, but we don't want to study, but spherical symmetry still gives us some sort of partial differential equation character we can study, so we study it in spherical symmetry first. And I'll present results from two different systems of coordinates we considered. So one was Schwarzschild-like coordinates where A and B are metric fields. They depend on time and the radius, the aerial radius. And also simulations in Panleve-Goldstrand-like coordinates, which take this form here. So we can think of this as the lapse, and this zeta as sort of a shift vector. And then we also have the spherically symmetric space. So first I'll talk about Panleve-Goldstrand coordinates just as a very fast review. These coordinates are horizon penetrating. So here's a Penrose diagram for those coordinates just for Schwarzschild black holes, where we just have these reduced to Panleve-Goldstrand coordinates for Schwarzschild black holes. The solution for the lapse is here and the shift is here. So we see that the shift dies off as 1 over square root r. So it's a very slow die off in zeta, but we have this nice property that each spatial section is flat. And that simplifies the equations a lot for us, and that's very useful. These coordinates, though, are not singularity avoiding. So if we take constant T hypersurfaces of Schwarzschild, they go all the way to the R equals zero. So we'll have to apply excision in our code. And how we find the equations of motion that we solve for numerically is that we take the EDGB equations and we take algebraic combinations of these equations of motion and Penleve-Goldstrand coordinates. And we can find that we find a ordinary differential equation, so constraint equations for our metric fields. And we can find an evolution equation for the phi field. And then
sorry to interrupt, but I think there was a question.
Yeah, sorry.
Hi, Justin. Sorry, I just want to ask, the EDGB, it's a type of FR gravity, right?
Sorry, who's that again?
Is it a type of FR gravity? It falls in the class of FR gravity theories, right?
It's a kind of a Horndesky gravity, but it's not a F of R gravity, no.
Okay, great. Yeah, because I think I slightly misunderstood what you were saying about the class of scalar tensor theories before. Carry on. Thank you.
It's not, we can't write it as a polynomial in the Ricci scalar. And just to talk a bit more of the numerical tools for the simulations I'm showing, we're solving this with second order finite difference methods, so standard things, and then we spatially compactify. So the coordinates I'm showing will actually go all the way to spatial infinity. And then because we'll have a lot of dynamics we'll be looking at black hole solutions, we'll be using adaptive mesh, some mesh refinement near the black hole just to resolve features. So the first thing that we studied was this theory has been studied, static solutions have been studied, and people have found scalarized black hole solutions to the full theory, but they didn't look at the dynamics. So we wanted to look at the dynamics of scalar hair growth in EDGB and just see if we could recover the results that had been found in the literature earlier. So in particular, what we did is we started with Schwarzschild initial data. So Schwarzschild is a solution to EDGB gravity. It's just not a stationary solution. And then we parametrize the initial data with this parameter C, which is lambda divided by the initial black hole mass squared. So this is a dimensionless parameter, and it roughly characterizes the strength of the EDGB corrections to the theory, to our solution. And we also compared our solutions to what's called the decoupled scalar field solution. So this is just people solve this equation, assuming a GR background. So assuming Schwarzschild black hole background and solve for phi, and we're going to be comparing with that solution. So this isn't a solution to the full EDGB, but it's an approximation. We want to see how well this approximation matches what we see. So this plot here, X again is our compactified variable. X over M equal to 5 is future spatial infinity. The black hole horizon that we began with was around here, and the solid blue line is the decoupled scalar field profile. And this curvature coupling here is 0.16. And we begin with initial data with phi is equal to zero. And we see that as we evolve in time, the scalar field grows. And at least for this relatively small curvature coupling, the full EDGB solution after say a few hundred M of evolution closely approximates what the approximation also gives us. And we can do this looking at different curvature couplings, and we see that as you might expect, as we increase this lambda parameter for a fixed black hole mass, the decoupled or the approximate scalar field hairy black hole solution gets worse and worse, but it's still not too bad. This is log 10. So even at this fairly large curvature coupling, the difference isn't that severe. It's maybe 1 in 50. So that was the first kind of study we did, is can we just get sensible evolution for this theory in spherical symmetry, and can we get scalarized black holes, which is what people expect this theory to have. We also studied the stability of these scalarized black hole solutions by making small little scalar field pulses in our initial data and then evolving in time. So here's the initial t equals zero pulse. And as we evolve in time for small enough curvature couplings, the scalar field, we get hair that grows and very closely matches to coupled, but then this, and then some of it grows and then some of the scalar field disperses. So again, for small enough perturbations and small enough curvature couplings, these scalarized black hole solutions are stable. This is encouraging to going to the full nonlinear case. So far so good for EDGB gravity. And now we're gonna study, this prompts us to study the theory in a more, for larger values of lambda for our given parameters, and see, does the theory still make sense for the full parameter range of lambda? So we can go back to one of the challenges to studying the full solutions to modify gravity theories. So we have to understand if the theory has well-posed initial value problem, obeys cosmic censorship, has these good properties, in particular, has a strongly hyperbolic formulation. So just to review, hyperbolicity means that all of the characteristic speeds of your theory are real. Well, for our cases, that's what it will mean. And we can think of it physically, the characteristic speeds, as the speed at which high frequency linear perturbations travel about your background solution. So just to take a toy theory, if we were trying to solve the equations of motion for this here, the characteristic speeds would be 1 over square root h over x, or h of x. These are functions of the background. So we see that the characteristic speeds don't depend on lower derivative terms. It's just the highest derivative, or the principal part of your equation, determines the characteristic speeds. So when h is bigger than 0, this is real, and we can solve this, and it's a hyperbolic just wave equation. When we try to compute the characteristic speeds for EDGB gravity, and we what we find when we go through the standard procedure is that the characteristics, which are speeds, which are these c here, satisfy in spherical symmetry an equation of this type. So it's a quadratic equation where script A, B, and C depend on the metric variables, your scalar field, and their derivatives. So the characteristic speeds at which the EDGB scalar field is propagating on, it depends on your background. In a complicated way, so I haven't listed these here, but they were listed in the papers that I presented at the first slide of this. And we see that since it's a quadratic, that there are three different kind of solutions to this, where that are determined by the discriminant. So both characteristic speeds could be real if the discriminant is bigger than zero. They could be, well, the discriminant could be zero, and then this is a parabolic solution. And then if the discriminant is less than zero, the characteristic speeds are imaginary, and our equations are of fundamentally elliptic type. So there's three different partial differential characters that are governed by this characteristic equation. And that will determine how we can find solutions to this theory. If it's hyperbolic, you can set up an initial value problem and evolve in time. But if it's an elliptic problem, you have to set up boundary value and then solve that. This analysis is most clearly seen in our runs we do in Schwarzschild-like coordinates. So I'm going to flip now to this. It's a similar procedure to find the characteristics, but now the metric fields are these. And these coordinates are not horizon penetrating, but we're not going to look at black hole solutions here. So that's not an issue for us. In this set of studies, we looked at a scalar field Gaussian pulse like this, and we evolved this in time. We made it mostly ingoing, and we looked at the characteristics in these coordinates. So here's a case where parameter lambda times the Ricci scalar is dimensionless, and that's when we can sort of look at the solutions here when there's no black hole. And this is a solution. This is a run where this was always very much less than one. So blue is the scalar field profile. Green is the outgoing radial characteristic. The orange is the ingoing. And this is a case where we had an imploding scalar field and it began to form a black hole, but since these coordinates are horizon penetrating, the simulation just sort of stopped running at some point because time froze. But the idea is that there was completely regular behavior again, just like in the earlier solutions I showed with the scalarized black holes. Nothing surprising here. Again, everything looks promising. But now we're going to look at a set of solutions where the imploding scalar field sourced curvature that such that r times lambda started growing large or around order one, or in this case 0.1. So the way to read this plot is this here is the x-axis is the radius divided by m and time divided by m here. So the bottom is the null characteristics. This is what we just normally calculate in a GR. So null geodesics would propagate along null characteristics. And this is just telling us that here in this panel that the geometry of our solution remained smooth and there was no black hole forming as we evolved in time. But then we computed the EDGB characteristics for the scalar field. And we find that at some point, at some critical value here, that the characteristics went from real to imaginary and the equations changed character from hyperbolic to elliptic. And since our numerics were set up to solve hyperbolic equations, our code very quickly crashed after the formation of this elliptic region, is what we're calling it here. And we can look at the onset of when the hyperbolicity fails for various Gauss-Bonnet couplings, say. So we can do a study where we fix the width of our initial scalar pulse, W, and then we can vary A and ask, well, how does the onset, the coupling we need for a fixed R naught and W naught, what is the coupling we need to form an elliptic region? And we see that as the parameter A of the initial scalar field pulse, the amplitude decreases, the Gauss-Bonnet coupling increases. And you can just think of this as a reflection of the amplitude sources of a Ricci scalar curvature. So as curvatures are decreasing, we have to go to larger, and those it roughly obeys some sort of 1/lambda relation here. The idea is that for sufficiently large lambda, we can get a loss of hyperbolicity for very small curvatures, but they form a, at least for this class of initial data, a fairly tight relation over a few decades of parameter space. So what does this mean? What this means is these equations for EDGB gravity, at least in spherical symmetry, are what's called mixed type equations, where and mixed type equations are equations that can be hyperbolic in some solution space and elliptic in other solution space. And these equations have been studied for almost 100 years now. And one of the oldest examples of this is Tricomi equation. So this is an example you can keep in your head is that here we see with the Tricomi equation that when x is less than zero, it's hyperbolic, and when x is greater than zero, it's elliptic. And that changes how you solve it. And along x equals to zero, you get this degeneration between these two types of solutions, and it's called the sonic line. And that's the language we're using here. So it's this boundary here is called the sonic line of our solution. This terminology, just for some historical background to this, the terminology for sonic line comes from fluid dynamics, because when you study the equations of motion for steady state solutions to the inviscid compressible Euler equation, they also obey a mixed type equation, such that since the steady state, the equations are elliptic when the bulk fluid velocity is less than the sound speed, but when the bulk fluid velocity is greater than the sound speed, the equations become hyperbolic. That's why the transition between elliptic and hyperbolic is called the sonic line. And that terminology is stuck with other mixed type equations. And these have been studied, even numerically, people have successfully numerically studied those equations since the 70s. And this is just an example of that. And for more information, you can go to some of the mathematical literature on this. And just to mention that when an equation becomes elliptic, it's not that the equation is becoming unstable, because if the solution was unstable, we'd expect it to evolve to a new solution that is stable. But instead, when the equations become elliptic, we can't think of the equations as evolving because they're not hyperbolic anymore inside this region. Instead, we should think of it as we need to think of a new solution technique to apply boundary conditions here, including boundary conditions future in time, to get any sort of sensible solution to this. Now, of course, while in fluid dynamics, the mixed type property is well understood in that it's an artifact of the approximation of steady state flow and being inviscid. For a modified gravity theory like EDGB, the interpretation of this mixed type character is obscure and probably indicates the theory is sick in some fundamental way. Now I'm just to further explore this, I'm going to look at the mixed type properties for black hole solutions as well and see how does mixed type behavior enter the black hole solutions. I showed you earlier solutions where we weren't really investigating that. So now we're going to investigate that happens if we have initial data that has a black hole. So we're going to go back to Penley-Vogel strand coordinates. The summary of that is that a sonic line for EDGB black hole solutions, we don't find any sort of curvature blow up in our solutions. Instead, before we find curvature blow up, the geometry is smooth and regular, but the we find a sonic line and elliptic region forms, but no curvature blow up to that point. And for small enough curvature coupling, lambda over m squared, and remember m squared now is the, m is the mass of that black hole. For small enough values of this, the sonic line and elliptic region are inside the black hole. So this bad behavior is censored in some sense, but for large enough, the sonic line goes outside of the black hole horizon and it is no longer censored. Let's see. So here's an example of this. What am I plotting? So the top here is the radius of the marginally outer trapped surface of our black hole. So that's what we're taking as of our horizon. We have to excise a bit outside the elliptic region, but through some sort of extrapolation procedure, we can convergently estimate the location of the sonic line inside our black hole. And here we're finding that the, for this case, I don't have the curvature coupling listed here, but I think it's 0.1, that the curvature coupling, that the sonic line is well inside the horizon, which eventually grows and then shrinks. So the horizon, and that, I'm showing this at three different resolutions just to show, this is a resolution study showing that while the horizon looks like it's growing a little bit here, it's just an artifact of our finite resolution. Yeah, it's actually asymptoting to a constant value along with the elliptic line or the sonic line. So again, for small enough curvature coupling, the sonic line is inside the black hole. And we can look at the location of the sonic line as a value of the curvature coupling. So here we're plotting this on the bottom, and on the top we're plotting also the location of the horizon or the marginally outer trapped surface, and we see that they begin to approach each other. This is bending over a bit, but unfortunately for numerical reasons it was difficult to get to larger values without and resolving the difference, the difference between the marginally outer trapped surface and the sonic line. But if we go to quite a bit larger values of the curvature coupling than this, say 0.2 or 0.3, we find that, so here is the radius, here's the time, that the elliptic region rapidly outstrips the trapped region here and becomes naked and exposed. So in the theory, we lose a causal hyperbolic evolution. So just to summarize that, we find a breakdown of causal evolution for sufficiently large curvature couplings with our Schwarzschild initial data in Penley-Vogel strand coordinates. There's no quite universal, but for various classes of restricted initial data, we can find nice scaling laws like that earlier plot I showed you. And the general theme here is that large enough gradients can trigger elliptic region formation. But in order to get large gradients, that depends on the initial data. To review other kind of work on this, so other authors, for example, Louis Lehner at Perimeter and collaborators have considered spherically symmetric solutions to other classes of modified gravity theories. So G2 is a function of these two variables. G4 is a function. And they study this in spherical symmetry in the strong field regime and look at conditions to make this have well-posed evolution without shock formation, which I didn't talk about in this talk, but or elliptic region formation. There's also early work by Papalo and Rial who study these more general Hordesky theories, but with they consider various small corrections to these modifications to general relativity. And they look for gauge conditions that make those theories strongly hyperbolic. I don't talk about strong versus weak hyperbolicity in this talk just because there's only one dynamical variable and we're in spherical symmetry. So it's a bit of a simpler case. Also more recently, Kovacs and Rial have found a set of gauge conditions that may lead to well-posed evolution for small enough deviations from GR for EDGB gravity. So it's consistent with our results that For small enough deviations, we have well post-evolution, but for large ones, problems might happen, and their approach doesn't necessarily talk about that. So future work and works in progress. We're considering more general kinds of couplings to the Gauss-Bonnet parameter, because these are also considered in the literature of this theory, and more general potential terms. But we're also finding similar problems that when this corrections to GR, which this term here, so eta now is not, lambda is now the phi 4 coupling, but we're using now eta as our constant. When this is correction is large enough, we're also finding issues with the hyperbolicity of the theory. And that should be completed soon. But for small enough corrections, it seems to work, again, in spherical symmetry. So future directions with this kind of work is, we can ask, are there modified gravity theories that offer interesting solutions? For example, violate the null convergence condition, which is often used in early universe cosmology to avoid the initial singularity, but which also makes sense as classical field theories. And also one thing we could look at is to apply effective field theory approaches to numerical relativity simulations of, say, EDGB gravity, because these theories do seem to make sense for small enough couplings. So treating it more as a perturbative correction to general relativity with, and not trying to claim that this solve this theory as if it was a complete field theory, that should probably work. And one could do this to parametrize deviations from general relativity, especially with the binary merger, to get closer to astrophysics again. Okay, so I'm a little early, but just to conclude, we studied the nonlinear dynamics of EDGB and found that for subextremal couplings, the nonlinearly stable scalarized black hole solutions had elliptic region, but it was censored inside the horizon. For superextremal couplings, this elliptic region was outside. We could also find them, these elliptic region formation with no black hole at all, again, with sufficiently large coupling parameters. And this, in some sense, EDGB violates the weak or strong cosmic censorship. The theory does not have causal well-posed evolution for all ranges of initial data that are well-posed in the initial data surface. So it dynamically evolves the solutions where it can no longer, we can no longer solve it as an evolution equation. And as I mentioned, future directions in this sort of program include proving that this definitively is gauge invariant. So we haven't found made a rigorous proof of this, that this is a gauge invariant, but we have strong suspicion that it is, and heuristic arguments that it is. And apply this analysis to other kinds of modified gravity theories considered in the literature. And also to, importantly, search for theories that don't have this problem. Are there any, say, Horndesky-like theories that don't have this problem? Because those are the ones that would presumably give us interesting, strong field deviations from GR. And then also one could look at effective field theory solutions as well, and abandon the hope of looking at the strong field deviations from GR. And that concludes my talk, maybe a little early, but since we're on a tight schedule, maybe that's not a problem.
Okay, thank you very much, Justin. So if you have questions for Justin, just hit the raise hand icon and I'll call on people. So I can see, one question already. Go ahead, Edgaron.
Hi, yeah, Justin. One thing I want to ask, so with these strong field deviations, does that mean that it would be possible to constrain with things like black hole shadow images, like with like the EHT telescope, to like start like constraining these kind of theories?
Yes, I think if we could get a strong field solution that had well-posed evolution, we could begin to look at those deviations. I mean, you could also do that for weak field deviations too. I know that the Caltech Cornell group has looked at dynamical Chern-Simons and looking at the black hole shadow, which is perturbative corrections to GR. So yeah, that's definitely doable. Strong field, one could also do, but this theory seems to have problems in the strong field.
Yeah. Just to understand, this field doesn't fall like victim to any of like the constraints that you have with other theories from rather Horndesky theories that with gravitational wave merger observations, right?
You're saying, does it have other constraints on this theory or other ones?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The gravitational wave merges observations in terms of the CG limit.
I would say, I'm going to rephrase that a little bit. This theory does can be better constrained if you consider cosmological solutions to the theory, since the scalar field reacts to curvature with that Gauss-Bonnet term. You could spontaneously scalarize the universe and then get very strong constraints. And I know that's been done by Oliver Tattersall and Pedro Ferreira. In terms of gravitational waves, I know the Caltech Cornell group has also just begun looking at EDGB perturbatively as well.
Okay.
And are starting to consider what kind of constraints you could get there from that.
Okay. So yeah, with your data we already have with the mergers and stuff, then you'll be able to kind of start getting more.
From the perturbative approach, which is in some sense, it's guaranteed to have well post evolution, at least for short times.
Okay.
So that people, the Caltech Cornell group has, or Masha Kankova now at Flatiron is considering that approach.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Next, had a question from John. John, did you have a question? Okay.
John is probably muted, so that's why. So, John, you have to mute.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. Sorry. I just want to address the issue of possible observational testing. Mm-hmm. I suppose you don't have a current like axisymmetric solution for rotating black hole.
I think people have found static axisymmetric rotations. I think Nico Yunes and his student have found static axisymmetric solutions, but not dynamical.
I see. Not dynamical.
Yeah.
So I presume you, for branch-sticky scalar tensor theory, the branch-sticky coupling omega has to be very large to fit the solar system data.
Yes, and I think Branch-Sticky can be much more constrained because it can scalarize fairly strongly around solutions that have matter like neutron stars. So if you look at binary pulsars, I think you can constrain it much more strongly there because the scalarization is relatively stronger. What was interesting about this EDGB gravity was that it doesn't, let me go back to the theory. It doesn't scalarize as strongly for around neutron stars. So you could sort of avoid those constraints. And that was pointed out in this paper here. So the hope was that, well, black holes, you could get a stronger constraint.
Yeah, so for black holes around 5 to 10 solar masses, the curvature should be strong at the horizon, reasonably strong.
Yeah.
So that's the type of black hole that are observed by LIGO black hole mergers. Can you apply this theory to that?
I would say the smaller the black hole, the more problems you're going to get into because the dimensionless parameter that is controlling things is, to make it dimensionless, you have to divide it by the relevant mass or length scale. So smaller black holes, you get stronger deviations. So you're getting more into the quote strong field regime of this theory. So in fact, people have looked at static solutions and found, and we're agreeing with their results that in some sense is a minimal black hole mass for this theory. For a given fixed lambda, which is a constant, there's always a minimal black hole mass.
So supermassive black holes, M87 star, the curvature is very weak at the horizon.
Yeah, so it'd be the strongest constraints would be the sort of near the smallest black hole.
So can you predict, for example, the size of the shadow for M87 star cast by the black hole?
I haven't computed that, but I know that at least perturbatively, the Caltech Cornell group has done this for dynamic culture and Simons, and I think other researchers have looked at static solutions to EDGB and looked at the strata recently as well, but I have not personally investigated that calculation.
Do you know what they get?
I don't remember right now, no.
Oh, sorry. Okay. No.
But I definitely, you want to have this be as close to one as possible to get a reasonably strong, large constraint, but we're finding that when this gets close to one, you start running into problems with the theory.
So the speed of gravity waves is still the speed of light.
The speed of gravity does change. When the scalar field is not zero, the speed of gravity does change. And that can give you another constraint. So if there is some sort of cosmological scalar field, EDGB scalar field, because the dispersion relation for gravity changes, I think, again, Ferreria and at Oxford, they can get very, very strong constraints on this parameter if you assume it's if it's cosmological, because then gravity does not actually travel at light speed.
Yeah, because the neutron star merger data shows that gravity waves move with 1 pound 10 to the 15.
Yeah, so if
that must be a strong constraint.
If you assume it's a if you assume phi is cosmological and it has some cosmological sort of dynamics, you get a very, very strong constraint, much stronger. It's essentially, much stronger than you would get from trying to do a direct simulation with it.
Does it exclude the theory?
It excludes the theory if there's a cosmological, if the EDGB scalar has cosmological dynamics. So if you want to use this to drive dark energy, then it is essentially excluded, at least according to their analysis.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Question? Yes, hi, Justin. I wanted to ask you what you meant by checking if your conclusions are gauge invariant. I mean, one of the things that this scatter field is doing in this coupling is modifying, and this is related to the previous question, modifying the speed of propagation of information. So the thing you're homing in is already gauge invariant. So I'm not sure I understood what that comment was.
I think the idea was that would there be a way of choosing your lapse and shift cleverly enough that you could somehow make the characteristics real instead of imaginary? And I mean, we're pretty sure that you can't ever do that, but to have like a formal rigorous proof, like directly just looking at the symbol of the theory and there's some gauge symmetry showing that there's some sort of irreducible part to the symbol that won't change from real to imaginary based on your gauge choice. That was the idea of that statement.
All right, thank you. Got a question? Unmute.
Is it me that you're calling?
Yeah, please go.
Ah, okay, so yeah, sorry. Justin, could you go back to the picture you have about the radius of the surfaces?
Here?
For a second.
Here.
That one, yeah. So this is the radius of the apparent horizon?
Yes, the top one here. Yeah, these three ones.
It goes down, right? So this is an area radius, right?
This is the aerial radius, R.
So your apparent horizon is shrinking?
Yes. It grows, then it shrinks, and this is consistent. So I didn't show a plot of this, but the theory does, we do see violation of the null convergence condition.
Okay.
So it's consistent with all the theorems about horizons growing. If we can violate that condition, it's not inconsistent. So, yeah.
Okay.
And I guess it's interesting that we can see this to be violated and actually have the sort of the bad elliptic part hidden. So that's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Juan, you had a question?
Justin, nice talk. So I remember you mentioned for this EDGB, for small enough coupling, you can always ensure strong hyperpolicity. Do you have an estimate, like quantitative estimate on the initial data? For example, if binary black hole space time? Like, do you have an idea of what kinds of coupling that you can make sure it's well posed, and then you can actually do this kind of simulation, right? Like, because people, like, for example, Marsha did it in this perturbative way, but one can argue that for a long time, maybe this perturbative way will fail, and it will be good that if we do it non-perturbatively, even for small coupling.
Yeah, I think, I know that the restriction on lambda that we get for a given black hole mass is very, almost essentially over aligns with this result by Sotiriou and Zhao, where they looked at static black hole solutions. And I couldn't give you an actual number in kilometers. I used to have it in my head, but I couldn't give it you in kilometers right now for a given black hole. But I mean, in principle, you could say maybe, but I'm a little cautious because this is in spherical symmetry, and we already see this dramatic failure in hyperbolicity for sufficiently large lambda or for sufficiently large curvature. And going to higher dimensions, there's more degrees of freedom that are activated. And since we're only looking at the scalar field dynamics here, but higher dimensions, there's also the gravity dynamics, and those are also modified by EDGB. So I think we'd have to analyze to see if those are also have hyperbolic evolution as well in this theory. And our analysis doesn't say anything about that. So I think one would need to investigate that before being able to say confidently that this theory could be simulated in full for weak enough couplings. That being said, I know this recent work by Kovacs and Rial claimed to have found a gauge that makes it have sensible evolution for small enough coupling, but that's in some sense, you would get results probably consistent with the order reduction approach of the Caltech-Cornell. As long as the order reduction approach is being done correctly, they should probably give similar results.
But that's something I think worth to check whether it does give the correct.
Yeah, I think it's something to check, and I think it's something we're going to look into. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
But at least with this panel here, even for very small lambda, as lambda gets smaller and smaller, you can still have elliptic region formation. This, the curvature at which that will happen gets larger and larger. So,
okay, maybe I'll ask a question, then we can go to second rounds of questions from everyone. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, at the beginning of your talk, you mentioned the sort of cosmological interest in at least these class of Horndesky theories for getting bouncing solutions and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I know you didn't sort of study exactly those particular solutions, but based on these results, would you say that the ones that sort of give you bouncing solutions are in the so-called super extremal coupling limit and would probably suffer from similar breakdown of hyperbolicity?
So I know for at least the Galilean theories, even if you do linear perturbation theory, these have problems even about FRW, or they can. So these have to be augmented, and that's what kind of led to these more terms here. And these theories, at least the analysis by Aish and Steinhardt showed that for FRW, these are perturbatively hyperbolic through a bounce. So there might, it maybe that result would hold for solutions sufficiently close to FRW. But I think one would need to relax their background symmetry assumption. I don't think it's fair to map our results to what they do quite yet. I think one would need to do an analysis of what they do. But at least they have done linear perturbation theory of this theory about a bouncing solution and found that it was hyperbolic all the way through the linear perturbations. I'm sort of paraphrasing a little bit, but that's sort of the gist of these theories. But I think one would need to do analysis in a more symmetry relaxed situation, like spherical symmetry or something.
Okay, thanks. John, you had another question? You have to unmute.
Recently there have been some papers in which they claim to have an Einstein-Gauss-Bernier theory, which is non-trivial in spite of the topological total derivative problem, which makes it identically zero. They claim they rescale the Einstein-Gauss-Bernier coupling alpha into alpha over d minus 4. And they take this peculiar singular limit, d goes to 4, and claim to get something sensible. What is your opinion about this?
Franz and I have been talking about this, but I don't have an opinion on it yet. It looks like I need to read it very, very carefully to see if it makes sense.
It doesn't. It probably doesn't make sense for in general. They've only shown it's supposedly sensible for spherical symmetric solutions.
Yeah, I don't think I've read that carefully enough to have a coherent opinion on it quite yet.
Okay, thank you.
Pablo, you had a question?
Yeah, thank you, Will. Hi, Justin, how's it going?
Good, thank you.
Nice talk. I was looking at the graph where you plot the Gauss-Bonnet coupling and the amplitude of the, you know, initial of your scalar field perturbation. And I was wondering if, you know, kind of like this formation of the elliptical region could be thought of kind of as a critical collapse kind of thing, where you're forming this, you know, instead of forming a black hole, you show your elliptic, well, your equation changes character, and now you have an elliptic situation there. Like, would you expect some universal behavior or some critical exponents or something like this?
At least from the simulations I've looked at, I don't see anything necessarily universal about the solution, except that the geometry always does seem to be smooth, very smooth up to the formation of it. So it's not like the Chop-Tuick scaling where maybe the curvature starts to grow. This power law scale, the scaling here with this fixed parameters is suggestive of something, but I don't see I haven't found a parameter to look at, say Ricci scalar or some sort of scalar like that indicates any sort of self-similarity or discrete self-similarity or anything like that.
But like for each Gauss-Bonnet coupling, those A zeros are basically the quote unquote critical A zeros, right? Because after that you form the elliptical region.
It's the critical A zero with these fixed. Yeah. So I guess, yeah, I mean, it is suggestive of something, but I don't see other features of criticality, like self-similarity in the solution.
Right.
Yeah. It might be interesting to see if one could investigate that a bit more in detail, but maybe our coordinates aren't resolving that well enough or something. If there was something there.
Okay, well, thank you.
Louise, you had another question?
I just have a question, half a comment, I guess. So, as you pointed out, so, you know, especially in this plot that is it's on the screen. So there is a dependence on the coupling as to when is it, and the amplitude as to when is that you observe the problem. So that's for the fixed value of omega zero. Mm-hmm. So if you were to change that, then this curve would change significantly. So now, going back to your comment of spherical symmetry versus what would happen in the real 3D situation, okay, black holes or any strong curve region will tend to focus. So one could start with a scalar field that is sufficiently smooth, but then the very focusing of the space-time can then probe shorter wavelengths, which will exacerbate its problem. So I think one thing that your paper works and shows very nicely, and then people should pay a lot more attention, is that all these calculations where they're doing perturbative things, they are by fiat assuming a lot. And so actually, I like your optimism with respect to the results that people are obtaining from perturbative analysis. There is a lot that needs to be done before I would begin to believe they are doing something that may be reasonable. So do you have a similar plot or study as how things depend when you change omega zero?
I've investigated, but I don't have a plot of it, no. But it obeys I think it obeyed a scaling law, but it was more complicated. And it wasn't just a line. It wasn't like a 1/lambda. It was a little more complicated, but it had the same kind of, you know, it goes down to up to down, or it has that same slope, negative slope.
Yeah, I wonder if there is a connection with, so if one goes back to the early works of Fitz-Jones, when he's mm-hmm. actually just providing an estimate of when the shocks will arise, given the mm-hmm. derivative of the content of your initial data, where one can make contact with that mm-hmm. in combination with how is it that it shows up in the high curvature terms.
Yes, it would be interesting to look at, because I know Fitz-John also looks at he's looked at these kinds of non-standard kinetic theories a little bit, lower order terms, and has a few methods that he's used to prove blow up, for example. So I think it'd be interesting to see if his methods could be adapted so one doesn't have to like laboriously go through a numerical simulation every time, but could use some more generic features of the equations to say yes or no to it.
Thank you.
Okay, well, if there are no other questions, let's all thank Justin again for the nice talk. So thanks, Justin.
Yeah, thanks for letting me speak.